You are listening to the podcast That's Life in Sweden, or as we say in Swedish, Sånt är livet i Sverige, with me, your host, Lisa Orsimäki. So today I'm speaking with Associate Professor Pauline Bremner from Robert Gordon University, and who I met during the Higher Education Teaching and Learning Conference held in Aberdeen in Scotland in June. Welcome to the program, Pauline.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me along, Lisa. It's great to speak to you again. It feels like a long time since June.
So how are you and how was summer?
I'm not too bad, thank you. Summer's been busy. Been out to Mallorca, where it was supposed to be a heat wave at the time, but it didn't transpire that way, so it was quite good for us as a family. But been busy with the, we have a dog, so been busy walking the dog and just gardening and things like that. So it's been good to get out and about for a while, but back at work now. Oh.
Well, welcome back. Yes, it is time to get back to work. Now, you have a background in retail and fashion management. This is an area that you also lecture in. So what made you interested in fashion management, and how did your interest lead you to take on university study?
Okay, brilliant. Thank you for that excellent first question, Lisa. I'm going to go back a little bit further. My original study interest was in hospitality, and when I left school I did an HND, a higher national diploma in hospitality at what's now known as Dundee University, and I kind of worked in that sector for about 7 to 8 years. But I also had always wanted to kind of get into lecturing in a way, or teaching and lecturing, and whilst I was working in hospitality, I did some evening classes, which worked out quite well. I'm not using the right word there, but it worked out quite well because I ended up with a diploma in personnel management. And once I had that, I kind of shimmied into lecturing. A job came up with Robert Gordon University, and I was lucky enough to get that. So I joined and started my path teaching in hospitality areas. But I soon realised that I was quite interested in people, consumers, you know, and how they behaved. And an opportunity came up for me to do an MBA in retail at Stirling University. And I went off and did that. And once I'd done that, there were various areas in there that I really liked, like sort of distribution, logistics, supply chain, strategy and business, things like that, I was really interested in, and consumer behaviour as well, because it's changing all the time. You know, there's so much happening in society, you know, in the external world, that it's interesting to see, you know, why we buy, what we buy, how we go about doing things. So I became very, very interested in that aspect. And then we introduced a retail undergraduate degree, which then kind of morphed into a fashion management degree, because fashion became more relevant, I think, than food retail, you know, as a kind of like discipline within universities.
Now, part of your MBA was you did a research study examining consumer perceptions in men's fashion. What were your reasons for this study, and what were some of your findings?
Thank you. Yes, I enjoyed studying my thesis during my MBA in retailing at Stirling University. And I kind of cottoned on to doing menswear for two reasons. One, it's often overlooked, or they're often overlooked, you know, as fashion people. And there wasn't a lot of literature around. There wasn't a lot of research about how they shopped and how they did things. So the thing that I looked at most specifically, I think, was a couple of store chains that did menswear as well as ladieswear, I hasten to add, that I examined. And these stores don't exist anymore because they were part of Arcadia. Or one was anyway, part of Arcadia. And of course, Arcadia's gone from our high streets now. But what I looked at specifically was the interaction, the service interaction at the kind of checkout and till point, because a lot of the literature pointed to the fact that that was an area where you could make or break your relationship with the customer, i.e. they might not come back if they don't get served correctly. You know, so because the employee plays a role at that point, it's almost like a performance. You know, you've stepped into that role of the kind of service giver, and it can make or break that relationship. One of the things that two things I identified, but the first one was that males did like to be served by someone at that checkout of the same gender and often of the same age. So they didn't want to be misjudged or overjudged or something like that by a person who's maybe younger or a different gender serving them. And because of the time that I was doing this, because it was early 2000s, it was clear that males were beginning to shop for fashion. You know, that turn of where it was becoming a thing for them to do was becoming clearer. Yeah, there's a lot of men coming in, perhaps with their sons even, you know, and shopping together, which was kind of, you know, the start of that kind of trend in a way.
And of course, that would have been then the next phase that would happen with, for example, you can see stores like H&M or Hennes & Mauritz, they have both men's, women's and children's. They produce, and you can go into the same. Do you have the same in the UK?
Oh, yes. One of our bigger chains, Next, which I don't think has it's reached some parts of the globe, but maybe not your part of the globe. But they were kind of one of the front runners in a way. And it's almost like, you know, ladies or males can go in and shop the same almost for their children. So it's developing that mini me, you know, you're almost able to kind of, you know, shop in the same kind of jeans or shop in the same jumper, you know, my child can wear the same thing, until of course they reach that age where they say, I don't want to look like you. I'm going to shop for my own stuff.
Yes, exactly. And yeah, it's interesting. But you know, the other one that you just mentioned, you talk about the what makes a good store, and it's the actual service provided by whether it is the at the checkout or whether it is the person who whose help you seek out as the consumer. And that's very similar to hospitality.
Yeah.
Because if the service is no good, it doesn't matter how good the food is.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's where my interest really kind of generated from. I like learning things. I like not relearning them, but learning new things. I like to, you know, I'm curious. I like to find out why, you know, things have changed. And I was very service orientated in hospitality, because the jobs I had were, one was in roadside catering. So I was managing roadside restaurants. So I was serving consumers. And it was clear, you know, you can't please all of the people all of the time, you know, but you do have to work at it, and there's a certain knack to it. And my second role in hospitality was actually in a hall of residence for University of Aberdeen. And it's the same kind of thing, you know, although it's students, so it's not in the profit-making area, but, it, you know, it's a similar thing. It's building those relationships. It's about the employee understanding that they're demonstrating the reputation of that company, you know, and it's so important, because if the product's doing the job, but then it all falls apart in that last bit, it's the same on the internet. Yeah, your customer might not come back again. You know, if things are out of stock, you know, if that, I mean, that's a really annoying thing online. I don't know if you experience that as well, but you would try and buy something online and then it says it's out of stock, and you're like, well, why are you showing that it's on available?
Yes, you know? exactly. Yep. Talking about education, coming back to education and the relationship between education for sustainable development, that is a big thing. Yeah. And I'm curious, how is it playing out in fashion today? Who has got the social responsibility? Are we looking at the individual? And while there is a role individuals play, but what about the role of the actual fashion stores or the one who actually is producing the fashion?
It's very, very difficult. You know, if we look back to things like corporate social responsibility, that kind of came, and that was really supposed to be the whole start of this kind of movement. It kind of came, floated around a bit, and everybody got a CSR department, and that was it. But I think it's very difficult. We've got the kind of social or the moral social responsibility round over shopping and consumption, but consumption's grown immeasurably, you know, in the last decade, the last 15 years. I mean, it's phenomenal the amount of fast fashion items that are just, you know, worn a couple of times and thrown away or put into charity. And of course,
yes,
a lot of the charity stuff goes away to other countries. You'll find it in Africa, in some of the street markets, in some of the cities there. You know, I don't think people are aware of where things end up. But it's a very complex system, because obviously as fashion companies have grown, their supply chains have grown, they're global. So we're sourcing from the cheaper areas in the globe. That helps their economy. So really, at the end of the day, you know, there's an awful lot of complexities in who's responsible, you know, and what can be done about it. But I think it has to start, you know, somebody has to make the decision somewhere, whether it's politically, which I think it's going to have to be, or, you know, that, you know, we have to balance out, well, is there true profit here, or should we be, you know, being more sustainable? I mean, at Robert Gordon University, we're going through the checking of how well our sustainable development goals are embedded across our curricula, across every single degree in our GU. And we're kind of lucky in fashion, because you know, we do that quite a lot in fashion. We've got modules on sustainability, and across, you know, a lot of the modules that we have, there's the opportunity to embed some of the sustainable development goals in there. So we're making our students aware, you know, of the problems. And it's funny in a way, it's the generation we're teaching that are much more knowledgeable about it, yet they still buy fast fashion. So they're still creating the problem. But hopefully when they graduate, you know, they'll go into industry and start to try thinking about how to solve the problem. And it's going to be a challenge, but I, you know, it's going to have to happen, I think, at some point soon.
What do you mean by fast fashion?
Oh, right. Well, fast fashion are companies like Zara, H&M. If you look at Shein and the Chinese company, these are companies that produce fashion items at reasonably low cost, but they're very much trend led. So if a celebrity maybe on likes of Love Island wears something, you know, 95% of the female population of a certain age range will want to wear that item very quickly too. So it will be replicated quite quickly by some of these companies and sold very, very quickly. I mean, some of Shein's products sell for about £3 or £4. It costs more to ship them than it does to actually buy them sometimes. And some of the quality might not be as high. Well, it's not. So, you know, the intention is they don't last long. You know, and consumers will use them for the time the trend is there, and then move on to the next trend. So, you know, in some cases you're looking at 6 weeks.
6 weeks?
Yeah, they'll turn, you know, oh, I don't need that item anymore, I need to move on to the next thing. And Zara operates. Yeah, I know.
My God. 6 weeks.
Yeah, Zara.
Before I throw it out, sorry.
No. It you know, it can be. Yeah, you know, it very much depends on the trends. You know, some of the other companies, you know, Primark, some of the items that they sell are at such a price point that the younger generation who may be going on holiday, You know, for a fortnight, we'll fill a suitcase with Primark stuff and leave it all behind.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the original things of that. I'll give them their due. They have traded up. So, you know, there are pieces that they've got a range now across their stores, and that's not their image anymore to an extent. But, you know, there was a kind of change in that. But, I mean, fast fashion, is it driven by the consumer or is it driven by the companies? And that's, you know, the big thing that has to change. There was a polka dot dress, I don't know if you remember it, but Zara designed a polka dot dress that flew off the shelves. I can't remember, there was some hype around it, but again, you know, it's an example of how fast fashion can be, you know, when it wants to be. So very short lead times, very short using time.
But also very effective marketing.
Oh, yeah. A lot of social media is used. I mean, ASOS has its As Seen On Me hashtag. You know, so you buy the item, you send them a picture of you, or you post your picture of yourself on Instagram with the hashtag, and you become part of this great big ASOS community. You know, so these are the way that companies reach out. You know, or they'll get a celebrity influencer. They'll use them. And, you know, if I go back to Love Island, you know, it'll be a person maybe that's been on there that then joins up with Boohoo or something like that and wears their stuff. And then that's how you increase sales. Yeah. Mm. But, you know, it's changed quite a bit from when I was a kid shopping.
Yes. Now, I'm going to ask you then, follow up. Now, in 2015, you received your PhD, which examined the gift giving of toys to children from adults. So from the men's fashion, you now go entering gift giving of toys. Can you talk about why you chose the topic and some of the findings?
Yes. Now, I kind of debated what I was going to do for quite a bit of time. It's challenging trying to decide, you know, what you're going to do for a PhD, because as you'll know, it's not a short thing. It's quite a long chunk of your time is devoted to that. But I'd already had one child, my eldest, and I was fascinated by the amount of stuff that she received at Christmas, for her first Christmas, and it was all toys, and she was surrounded by toys, and I looked at them and I went, what are you going to use first? Why do we need this? What's that for? Why what is this? You know, and as usual, children then tend to play with the paper or the packaging. Yeah.
More interesting.
Yeah. And the other thing I kind of noticed was that her first birthday, a lot of things hinged around the actual birthday party, and not so much the gift giving. And there's kind of like an exchange happens. So, you know, she got a little bit older, you know, age two, there's a group of people, children that you invite to the party. And then there's kind of a swapping goes on, gifts around about, you say, £20 mark. But the birthday didn't seem to hold much, hold as much relevance as Christmas. Christmas, it was just stuff everywhere. Birthday, it was more about, you know, the monetary exchange. Like that gift's worth £20. So when you come to my child's birthday, you'll give me something that will be £20 worth, you know. So this got me thinking. And I was kind of surprised at the difference, you know, in the way that some people approach their gift giving. And as I looked a little bit into the gift giving literature, there's obviously quite a lot of history involved with that. It goes back to something called the potlatch in some tribal times or something like that. And I'm going to say the wrong thing, so I'm not going to say it. But you know, there's the rule of exchange. You know, I give you something, yes. You give me something, and that makes it okay. You know, you're developing the relationship, you know, the consumer relationship from that. So I kind of watched this for a couple of years, and of course, as they get a little bit older, you know, it changes. So that got me to thinking there must be something in this. So I went and did a bit of research, and there was. And toys are bought for various reasons by people, by parents, you know, by others, obviously, giving gifts to your child. And you could start to see categories forming. So, for example, some of the findings were, you know, depending on the person's socioeconomic status, if I can call it that, some would buy for educational reasons. That tended to be what I would call more professional people who were perhaps in, you know, a two-parent marriage, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? There's the...
Yep.
You know, there's two parents and there's a child. So you're looking at, I hate to use the term normal, but you're looking at, you know, a stereotypical kind of approach to it there. Others would buy for guilt. So a working mum might buy toys, more toys at Christmas, you know, for guilt reasons. Some would buy to please and reward children. So the thought would be the more you buy them, yeah, the more pleased and rewarded the child will feel. I don't know if you can feel that at age one or two. Single parents sometimes bought for guilt. I think I mentioned guilt earlier on, but some of the guilt that they perhaps felt was due to just being a single parent, you know. So the child doesn't
wow.
have a father present or a mother present, so I will buy more. Yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah. So
And what about grandparents?
Grandparents, I did interview some of the grandparents. It was mainly parents that were asked to fill in the questionnaire, or parents or carers. But you do have grandparents that fall into kind of like two categories. There's those that are quite restrictive, because I didn't get that one as a child, so you're not getting it. And those that go over, you know, over the score. It's like, here's 100 toys for you to play with. And, you know, as a parent, you actually have to say, can you please not give as much as that? Because, you know, and then my second child came along and then it became even more interesting because there's a balancing act to be done, you know.
Of course.
You've given that to the first one. Why are you not giving the second one?
Yes.
So, you know, very interesting.
But what about then, I'm just thinking about these gifts. So you have the professionals who are maybe, you know, they give the child something that they think this will enhance the child's intelligence, growth, whatever you want to call it. I'm always curious about, like you started saying, the child is actually more interested in the wrappings than the actual toy.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the main sort of questions, the main kind of findings. And obviously it's very difficult to interview children. I actually did a thing with them, and my eldest helped in one of the nurseries. We got permission to do it, and we got them to do drawings and draw their favorite toy and who had given it to them. And at Christmas time, the majority of them, depending on religion of course, highlighted Santa. And as we know, Santa does exist, but it's apparent that is in the guise of Santa nearer Christmas time, you know, and wish lists are formed and parents will buy around these wish lists. Yeah. And you've hit the nail on the head. The child maybe actually just wants to spend some time with the parent. She might all be on holiday together. The reward might be the relation, you know, doing something with your parent rather than having 13 toys to play with. And it's the same kind of thing for birthdays. So, you know, we've perhaps shifted from the ritual, you know, the true meaning of some of these things, and more into that exchange process, the consumptive process. But you're quite right, you know, so if a child's more interested in the, you know, the paper and the wrapping, that suggests they might actually just be wanting to spend time with mum and dad.
But isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
These kids, what kind of ideas do they grow up with? Are they the ones who will buy that suitcase full of clothes off to Mallorca and leave the whole suitcase? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and I'm glad you've asked that, because I've often reflected in that way. myself, you know, because we gift to ourselves as well, you know. So at the end of the month, when you get your paycheck, yeah, you rush out and buy something potentially, because that's you rewarding yourself for doing a month's work and woohoo, you know. So I'll buy all those things that I need, and I'll go off on holiday, and I'll do this, that, and the other. And what we're actually doing when we are gifting all these things, is a thing called, what is it? I can't remember. Oh, it's this, we're socialising. Yeah, it's a socialisation process we're going through. So we are educating our children to shop that way. And I think that's where that whole kind of consumptive cycle has started to grow. So, you know, the marketing that exists around Christmas, you know, Easter eggs are on the shelves at Christmas time. What? You know, the real rituals are being broken, you know, and we're forgetting the true meaning of the gift. I am gifting you this because I want to, not because I'm loaded and I can afford to, because I actually want you to have this, but I want you to have a memory with it. And I think that's the key thing. So we started maybe not buying our children so many gifts, but maybe going away to London for a weekend. And they both said, oh, we'll remember this. And I thought, you're going to remember that better than a gift.
Yes.
So I think, you know, it's that whole thing. It's that object, you know. A gift doesn't have to be an object. It can be an experience. It can be a, you know, an inanimate thing, in a way. But I think you're right. It will socialise them much more in that respect of, you know, filling up the suitcase and heading off to Mallorca.
Yes, exactly. Well, do you think in some ways then consumer perceptions about both fashion and gifts have changed from, for example, when you first began studying, exploring the area? And so what from where you are today and from your, you know, your students and what your observations, what do you think has been the significant, if there has been a change? What's been the significant change you've seen?
I think I'm going to use the word disposable throwaway. I think we've become, and whether the internet has a, I think it probably does, internet and social media has a part to play in this as well. I think we've become driven more by, I need to have that thing because that's been shown to be popular, and I'll be popular too if I have that thing. That's where I think it becomes very complicated for our younger generation now, because I think they're bombarded with so much information that they don't have the opportunity to find their own identity and be an individual initially, you know, to shape their own path. And I think that's the one thing that has, you know, evolved out of it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So fashion is, so it's more companies driven, trends driven. So it's not the young person. I mean, I'm just thinking back to the 70s and, you know, there was no way you were looking at social media to figure out what you were going to wear.
No, absolutely not. I mean, I had the choice when I was a kid of shops like C&A, British Home Stores, Marks and Spencers, and I think it was like Chelsea Girl, you know, and C&A was the go-to shop, you know, for fashion things, but it wasn't as fast, if that makes sense. It wasn't trend led. It was in your traditional summer, winter, spring, summer, autumn, winter, you know, and you were taken out, you got your new school clothes, you got your winter coat, and then come springtime, you got some shorts and t-shirts and things, and then that was it, you know. And I don't know, fashion wasn't a big thing yet in the 60s. It was, you know, we had different sort of strains of fashion coming through, you know, right the way through. You go back to Victorian times, you know, all the way back down, you know, Egyptian era and whatever, you know, but it wasn't perhaps such a big thing. And I don't know whether that's because society was just picking itself up a bit, Kind of post-war. I mean, 60s, okay, there's a bit of a time between that and the war, but it takes time for societies to kind of get back on their feet again after these things.
Sure. Can you talk about your current role and about the Go Robert Gordon University Innovation Award?
I will start with my current role. My current role as associate professor means that I still do obviously some teaching, but I'm busy working away on some research at the moment as well. So one of the research teams I'm involved with is looking at students' independent learning or the lack of it, or their perceptions of what independent learning is. So our expectations as academics are maybe slightly further ahead of what a new student coming into university thinks they should be doing. So I think there's a little mismatch in there, and we've been finding out some interesting things on the research there. One of the other pieces of research I was working on, and actually submitted a paper to the HETL Special Edition,
Yes.
is on pedagogic methods of teaching. And this one was using design thinking teaching. And we interviewed some of the participants who'd gone through the RGU Innovation Award. And we found some themes around that they enjoyed being taught in this particular way, this just a design thinking way. So in my role, I have my teaching part of it, and I have this research part of it. And also I am kind of involved in the RGU Innovation Award in that I helped bring it to RGU in a way. Now, the RGU Innovation Award started off as a Scottish Innovation Student Award. It was actually run by a company called Scottish Institute for Enterprise. I don't know if you'd heard of them before.
No.
But RGU worked quite closely with them, and there were three levels in there. And between myself and the person who created the programme, Anne Davidson, who's now at Cambridge, who created that programme, we developed an accreditation process. It has three levels, and we developed an accreditation process for RGU level one. And that increased the number of students going through the programme. So to give you a little bit of a flavour about what it is, what it was, it's now, as it stands, as the RGU Innovation Award, is an extracurricular micro-credential which develops your competencies for students and being able to respond to disruption, participate in the process of innovation and design solutions. So the award's open to all students in RGU, and it has three levels. So level one will explore innovations of the future through subject-focused workshops. Level two will put innovation into action through participating in an interdisciplinary challenge event, and that's the key thing, is this interdisciplinarity and collaboration. And then the level three is about the innovative ideas that an individual comes up with, and they complete some tasks and whatever before getting their level three. So there are three levels to it, and effectively it's a what we call an extracurricular award. But when a student achieves that, it goes on to something that we have here. I don't know if you have it, but we have something similar called the HEAR report. So it shows that they've done some additional things, at university, and it's great for employment, so on and so forth. So the SIE unfortunately cessated. Their funding wasn't continued, shall we say. But because we at RGU had worked so well with them and had a huge number of students go through their programme, we were left with the legacy of SAISA, as it was known as, which we then rebranded and developed into our RGU Innovation Award. And that currently sits in our entrepreneurship, I'll get this round the right way, our entrepreneurship and innovation group at RGU. So that's doing really, really well. And it's going to be embedded, across the curricula in all degrees. That's the strategic direction anyway, because we believe it's quite important to give these students these extra skills. And the way that it's taught in sort of these short design thinking type workshops, actually enhances, students' thought process, creativity, and things like that.
So when you mention the word, this couple of words, entrepreneur. Mm. What does it mean?
Entrepreneur is a difficult one to define, I think, because entrepreneurial traits can appear in anybody. You know, you can be entrepreneurial in your garden, you know, planting your plants and creating, you know, the best way to pollinate your plants in the future so that you're keeping nature going. So there's all sorts of things there. But I think the key word for me in entrepreneurialism, if you want to call it that, is about creativity. I think because of the education's gone, and I don't want to seem too critical, but, you know, we're kind of losing the place in our kind of primary and secondary school education systems on how to keep creativity going. And I think it's so important, you know, creativity and ideas, idea generation. You know, we need it for things like sustainability, you know, improvements. Mm-hmm. We need it for climate change improvements. It's a bit like the Earthshot kind of prize, you know. You know, you can come up with an idea, but let's actually put it into action. And I think we've become so bureaucratic in our approaches in a number of countries across the world. We're not clear enough to see that, you know, that clear direction. And if we strip away all the red tape and whatever, it's actually quite easy, perhaps, to get some of these things through, you know. So entrepreneurship is about having that will, I think, and that way and that determination.
Mm. And you believe that is something you can develop in young students. I like you said, starts in primary. Primary school children are real entrepreneurial. They're very creative if you let them.
Yeah, I think so. And I think we can see elements of that coming back in. But you know, to me, you know, we still tend to do things in silos. I don't know if you have that in your country, in your educational establishment. So, you know, when they get to secondary school, there's a department of English, there's a department of history, you know. Let's have a department of life, you know. Let's have a department of creativity. It's these things that are at the forefront rather than, you know, you need English. Yeah, I'm not saying let's not, you know, consider English, but English fits into everything, you know, maths fits into everything, you know. So I think it's just about a different way of wrapping it up, but making sure that the key
making
things
it more
get, yeah making it more relevant,
making it more interesting. Yes, interesting, yeah. and fun. And which brings me to the role of the teacher in your area of work. What skills or competences are necessary for people in your area?
Yeah, oh me. Now I had to think about this for a while. I think there's many skills and competencies. I mean, I've been in my job, although I have changed titles, I've been there for 28 years. And I think, you know, some of the basic skill sets are still the same, but we maybe do it in a different way. So communication. Originally, it would have been with, wait for it, an acetate on an overhead. and a bit of paper. There's a handout. Whereas now, obviously, it's all technological. So you have to evolve and change with that. So you have to adapt your methods of communication. But, you know, there's writing, there's communication. I think resilience is key, your presentation skills. I think we've had to become more critical thinkers. I think, you know, if you look at the meta skills that have been developed, they're embedded into Skills Development Scotland, but you know, I think these are kind of key. But I think, you know, change has become a thing. So, you know, dealing with change, some people find it hard to evolve and change, and I think that's flexibility and adaptability. These things are coming along. I think one of the other things that's grown is, particularly, you know, in our role, is having a welfare hat on, you know, at least being able to point students or learners, as I like to call them, into, you know, in the right direction when they need help, which is sometimes very difficult, you know, to try and figure out what the best plan is, you know.
It involves some entrepreneurial skills.
Yeah, Ironically, I suppose in a way it does. We have to, as I suppose, professors of learning, if you want to call it that, but we have to be thoughtful about the different ways we can disseminate information and how it works differently for some people than others. So you have to be entrepreneurial. I mean, I plan everything, for my teaching, but I'll often stand in a room and go, that's not working. I'm going to change it to this, So, I might have a rough idea of what I'm doing, and then I'll just alter the way I've approached it because I'll sense the room and think, maybe not, and I think that's part of it, being able to see what might be the best approach, but and be entrepreneurial, thinking on your feet.
Absolutely. Considering your journey as an academic at the Robert Gordon University, is there an experience that you want to especially highlight as significant in your personal learning journey?
I think probably for me, maybe two things maybe stand out, or maybe three. I think I have had a great time doing things like continuous professional development and learning new things, which I really enjoy doing. So in terms of that, for my personal learning, I really enjoyed that. The other thing I like doing is mentoring. Mentoring others in, well, if you do this, this might happen. If you do that, that might happen. So I really enjoy that. So you're passing on your learning, the learn things that you've learned, in doing that kind of mentoring thing. And one of the other things I really enjoyed through that kind of learning journey is when my eldest, but she was only 4 at the time, helped me with my research when I was in the nursery, my research for my PhD, because age 4, we sat down, we chatted about the session we were going to do with our pals in the class, and she got round the table in the nursery and she led the session. I didn't have to do anything. There's this little 4-year-old, sort of marching around the table going, now you've all got a sheet of paper, now you've all got a pencil, and my mum's going to ask you some questions, and you have to draw for her. And that, it kind of opened your eyes a little bit. You think, this is how it works, she's learned from me. She's displaying,
Modeling.
she's modeling, and at the age of 4, and you're thinking, actually, you can help people learn. You can help people learn from a very early age. And at that age they're so sponge-like. But it's stood her in good stead. She still remembers doing that. It's a memory. It's a gift.
How old is she today?
She's 21.
Oh my goodness. And what does
I
she do?
know. My eldest is at the University of Aberdeen studying for a Scots law with English law degree. So she's going into her fourth
Okay.
year, her honours year, in September.
Fantastic. So what's next for you?
What's next for me? I think for me it is, well, I've got a potential coil project on the horizon. That's with somebody I met through the HEATL organisation. That's a lady in South Africa. That's on one of the modules. I'll be in contact with her soon. So the coil project will be quite interesting because it'll be interesting to see how that interdisciplinarity works and helps our students and helps their students. Bit of skills research coming up with a team. Also moving forward with the independent learning research. Hopefully two journal publications to be submitted before Christmas. And then just keep on teaching. So I suppose it's just thinking of the different things that are coming along, and what we can do. I mean, a couple of the teams that I'm kind of involved with are, starting to think about putting in funding applications for things, but you need to get published first, really, before you kind of start doing that. But it's on the cards.
It sounds like you're going to be very busy.
Yes, I know. Maybe a one of those things, but the kind of research, for me, once I'd done the PhD, actual research, you know, doing interviews or doing questionnaires, I really love that part of the gathering of the data. I'm not so quick with the analysis part, but what I find now is that having developed a few teams or being part of teams and going to things like the HESOL conference and making contacts there, when you start to find, you know, little teams that work together, it actually shares the load and it becomes easier, you know, and we're all learning from each other. You know?
Absolutely. And I remember from the HESOL conference, I loved the workshop that you and your colleagues, it was brilliant. Can you just share a little bit? What was the workshop about? Just to share with everyone who's listening, because I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, what you got on that day was an hour, 50-minute snapshot of what Chris, who's the head of our EIG group at RGU, runs in our Level 2 RGU Innovation Award. So they use the design thinking approach to get the interdisciplinary teams to start thinking about their innovation. They'll have been given a proposition beforehand. So like that customer, remember you were coming up with a customer profile.
Yes.
And that's the type of thing they'll do. So, you know, they'll think of a day in the life of whoever. Yeah. And then they'll be given the proposition of the business. Yeah, so it might be a charity, for example. And then they'll start to piece the two together, and then they'll start to come up with their idea. They'll start to ideate, you know, the ideas that's going to generate more employees or something like that.
Yeah.
But, so you did a part of that, and we specifically did it on education because, you know, they were all educators in the room, whereas normally for students it would be more business-focused.
It has been absolutely wonderful to catch up with you, and thank you so much for your time. And you have been listening to the podcast Sånt är livet i Sverige, or in English, That's Life here in Sweden, with me, Lisa Orsimäki. Till next time, take care of yourself and each other. Bye for now.